Okay, so again, apologies for the late start. What we'll do today is have a short, like half-length lecture on just saying a few words about input modeling and sort of mathematically how you can assure yourself that your input is properly represented in a mathematical fashion. And then for the second half of this slot, the demonstrator for this module, Irina Tal, will come in and talk about the assignment. And so if you have any questions for her, you know, will be a good time to ask her questions. And, you know, it's handy to get you all together and let her talk to you all as a group, or as many of you who as can make it. If you can't physically be here, that's fine. She's contactable by email, and we'll be happy to, well, she'll be happy to deal with you in any format that is necessary. Okay. So, last time we were talking about output analysis, which is essentially what sort of information can we glean from simulations. And we looked at a bunch of parameters that could be estimated, mean, variance, percentiles. And then sort of almost the core of the lecture was sort of what confidence could we have in this information. So it's one thing to measure it. It's another to decide whether it's good, representative of the system, etc. And so a confidence interval gave you some assurance that the sampled values and the parameters we estimated from the sample, well, the parameters that got estimated from sampled values were in some way close to actual system parameters. In order to use confidence intervals, we saw that we needed to have independent sampling, and typically this was achieved through multiple runs of the simulation. And basically everything was designed so that the underlying distribution of the data we were observing would be normal, and we based our confidence intervals on this normal distribution. We're going to look at another technique today called the chi-square technique, which will look a bit similar. The difference is that for the chi-square, we're not actually going to know what the underlying distribution of the data is, so it makes it more difficult to draw sort of valid conclusions. And then we also looked at methods for gathering our samples, our independent samples. So again, probably the easiest is independent, or the most straightforward is independent runs. Potentially you can just have one long run, which you divide up, excuse me. Which you divide up into segments. And at times, if there's no way to ensure that the samples are independent, then you can calculate correlations between samples and use that to adjust the values that you've taken. Okay. So our last topic in simulation is input modeling. Again, this material is drawn from Harry Peros and Jerry Banks primarily. And so the idea here is that one of the key components of a model is your input data. And typically, for your assignment, you're just assuming that you have Poisson arrivals. So we've just told you how to model the input. But if you have a real-world system, you probably want some realistic model for your input. And so how do you get that realistic model? Well, there's several ways. Method one, you can use expert knowledge of a system. And so that's relying on having those experts. Method two would be to gather sample data from real life systems and then somehow translate this sample data into a mathematical representation. Okay. Now, we already looked at one method for translating sample data into a mathematical representation, and that was to use a histogram and then use the histogram to generate the cumulative distribution function. Okay. A second method would be, and so that can be quite accurate, but you also can get fairly sort of tedious functions and then have to, again, generate the data for them. A second option is to fit, sort of do curve fitting, fit the data to well-known distributions. And the idea here is that a lot of well-known distributions are based on sort of actual physical phenomena or sort of processes that actually occur in the real world. So it may be that what you have is a typical process that, you know, does occur in the real world, and then what you would need to do is the distribution would have a number of parameters, and you would use the samples then to estimate the parameters. You'd use your knowledge of the system to pick what your distribution was, then the samples would estimate the parameters. Okay. An issue that arises with either of these techniques is the question of goodness of fit. So you have a bunch of samples. You now have a mathematical representation of the underlying distribution of those samples. And so the question you're asking yourself is, how close is that underlying distribution to the actual distribution of the samples? And the problem with answering that question is we don't know what the actual distribution of the samples is. Yeah. And so we're going to look at sort of two variants on this question. The first is looking at uniform distributions and random numbers. And then, so we've looked at a bunch of ways of generating random numbers. And the question is, if you generate these random numbers, how close are they to a genuine uniform distribution? Okay. Similarly, if we've observed data and we've picked some formula to represent our underlying distribution of our data, we want to know how close is that to the actual distribution. And so, again, what we're going to do is we're going to take our samples, we're going to compare them to what we would expect if the distribution was truly random, and try to draw a conclusion about whether it's likely that the distribution we picked is the same as the actual underlying distribution. Okay. And as I said before in the sort of wrap-up of, or the summary of last time, the technique bears some resemblance to their confidence intervals, but What makes it more difficult is that we don't actually know what the underlying distribution of our numbers is. Okay. So, just as a sidebar, I've included in this year's notes a list of well-known, by far not exhaustive by any sense, but a list of well-known distributions. And again, the motivation for using these distributions is that they have been created to represent sort of very certain specific occurrences in real life. Okay, so I'm not going to sort of linger on this, but again, certain distributions model certain specific things. And so, for instance, a binomial distribution is a coin flipping experiment. So it models the number of successes or heads in N coin flips. A geometric distribution models the number of trials to achieve K successes. So again, these are coin flipping type experiments. Poisson distributions model a number of independent events occurring in a fixed time period, and we know that they're related to exponential distributions, which model the time between events in a memoryless fashion. So you should have looked at that relationship in detail. Okay. Normal distributions are represent a sum of component processes. And then the ones on this page, by and large, the Erlang models a process which is a sum of several exponential components. Weibull is a more general form of the Erlang distribution. Then gamma, beta, triangular, empirical are essentially just flexible distributions that can be, again, used for the purpose of curve fitting. Okay, and so they'll have some rough shape, and then you can try and fit your data to that shape, rough shape. Okay, so essentially, well, again, these distributions represent real-life processes, or indeed just might give you a rough shape along which you can fit your data. In terms of actually fitting them to data, what you need to do then is estimate the parameters of the distribution. And again, I give a few examples here. We know the formula for Poisson distribution, and it has one parameter alpha, which is the mean, and again you can estimate that by using your sample mean. Similarly for exponential, you have one parameter lambda, which can be estimated as 1 over the sample mean. It would normally be 1 over the mean. It's 1 over the sample mean now. Normal distributions, the parameters are the mean and the variance, and so you can estimate using the samples of those two quantities. Okay, so if you pick a specific distribution, then you have to know what the parameters are and how those parameters can be estimated. Again, you can find that sort of thing in any book, so I won't go over it here. Okay, so now what do we want to do? We want to return to the question of goodness of fit. So we have a bunch of samples, and we want to assure ourselves when we pick a distribution that that distribution is similar to the samples. And so what I'm going to do, and so the first port of call in doing that will be the chi-square test. And for our uniform distribution, we're going to then continue on to look at other tests as well. Okay. And so the chi-square test is fairly easy to produce an example of in terms of a uniform distribution. So again, I'll run through an example of how we apply chi-square. Then we'll look at why a chi-square test might not be sufficient. Finally, we'll look at the chi-square test for other sorts of distributions. Okay, so we'll start with an example, and so we're going to assume we've generated some set of random variates. So I believe there are 100 of them here, and you know, if you just look at it, looks reasonably random, and but what we'd like to do is say, is it really close to a uniform distribution? Okay. And so we'll run through how a chi-square test is applied. And so you can think of chi-squares, they're almost like histograms. So you, whatever the range of your distribution, you divide it up into intervals. And if you do that, you'd expect a certain number of occurrences of numbers in each interval, depending on how many samples you had. So if you have a uniform distribution and you divide it up into equal size intervals, you would expect roughly equal numbers of occurrences in each interval. Now, it's not going to be exact because it is random, but you'd expect roughly equal. So, again, if we, that's just to save on drawing, if you had four that looks roughly random. Okay. And again, if the intervals are equal, you'd expect roughly the same number of occurrences in each interval if the thing is truly uniform, right? You're looking a bit worried. Okay. And essentially what the chi-square test does is we have our actual samples, and we have what we'd expect. And so the chi-square, again, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So I have 10 here, so I'd expect 2.5 samples in each. Not a good number, but anyway, we won't worry about that. And we see we've actually got either 2 or 3. But so what the chi-square test does is that it compares what you'd expect based on the distribution you've chosen to what you actually have in your samples. And it gives you some indication of whether those two values are close or not. Okay. So, in our example, we choose 10 intervals, and we had 100 samples. So, what we would expect is 10 samples per interval. So an equal number of samples per interval, since it's a uniform distribution. And if you actually go back and do all the tedious counting, you'll see you don't get quite 10 per interval. Sometimes you get 8, sometimes you get 10, sometimes you get 12. The highest is 14. So you don't get exactly 10 per interval, but again, that's, you wouldn't expect exactly that because it's one random sample among many. Okay. So we want to compare the two values, what we've actually observed from our samples and what we expect. So we can look at the difference between observed and expected. And so that gives you some idea of how far away you're getting. But you can't just, if you just sum those up, you'll always get zero. So you'll always get sort of equal numbers above and below the mean. And so a typical way of dealing with this is that you square your difference. Okay. And so that gives you some measure of the absolute difference between the two values. Okay. Now, that's not quite the end of the road for the following reason, and that is, it is possible that if we take even intervals, our frequency of occurrence may not be equal. So this is a different set of numbers on this slide. So, but what you'll see here is that this looks, I don't know, maybe more normal. So we sort of go from a small tail to a peak somewhere around 0.5 and back down. So it's definitely something that's pumped instead of flat. And in this case, the same difference can indicate sort of a greater or lesser percentage from the expected value. So, yeah, here we've got OI minus E squared is 4, but that's that difference of 2 is half the expected value, whereas here, a difference of 2 is 12, well, is 1/13th of the expected value, so you still are within, you've got 12/13th of the expected value. So, in some way, this difference of 2 relating to an expected value of 26, it should be looked upon as being closer to what you'd expect than a difference of 2 from 4. Okay. So the way to take care of that is to normalize your values by the amount you'd expect. Okay. And so if we were to do this for this example, we would divide this 4 by 26 and this 4 by 4. So in one case you'd get 1, in one case you'd get 4 over 26 or 1/13. So again, it becomes a measure of how close you are to the actual expected value, not an absolute distance term. Now we return to our original example where we have a uniform distribution, and so, you know, dividing by 10 is it's again just a normalizing factor. Okay. And so we have for each of our intervals then a measure of how far we've strayed from the expected. And so all we do is we sum all those up. And so that gives us for the whole sample range some idea of how far we are away from what we expected. That value is called the chi-square value. Okay. Now, this value is randomly distributed because our observations have an underlying random distribution. We don't have as good a handle on what the distribution of this value is, but there's the chi-square distribution can be shown to be, well, the chi-square distribution is developed to represent this number. Okay. Now, the chi-square distribution, like the student's t-distribution, is dependent on the degrees of freedom in the system. The degrees of freedom is calculated as the number of intervals minus 1. So when you have all the intervals, then once you have 9 of them, you know what the 10th one has to be. So that's one less degree of freedom. And also, you have to take away the number of parameters that you've estimated for the distribution. So, for instance, if it was a Poisson distribution, you would have estimated one parameter as well, so you take away one more. For the uniform distribution, you don't estimate any parameters. Uniform is just between 0 and 1. It's fixed. There's no estimation of parameters. So, for the uniform distribution, the degrees of freedom is n minus 1. Okay. And so you get this family of distributions which come closer to approximating a normal distribution as the number of degrees of freedom increase. Yeah. Okay. So, as I said last time, our degrees of freedom for our example is 9. We have 10 intervals, and then take away 1. So it gives you 9. And now, like for the confidence interval, what we're going to do is choose a significance, which is some percentage value, and which represents the probability that the chi-square value lies above the critical value chi-squared. Okay. And so basically we don't want to be in this tail. And for the test, what we do is we've calculated our chi-squared value. We compare it to the critical value, and for our chosen level of significance. And if it's less than our chosen level of significance, we conclude that our sequence is, well, distributed however we thought it was, in this case, uniformly. Okay. So, looking at our example, we can choose a level of significance of 5%. We have 9 degrees of freedom. We have chi-squared tables, like our normal tables and our students' t tables, comparing degrees of freedom to significance levels. And for this, we see that our critical value is 16.919. Our chi-squared value was 3.4, which is less than 16.919. And so the conclusion we draw is that our sequence is uniformly distributed. Okay, so as a test goes, again, it works fairly similarly to the confidence intervals. You compare your value to some other value. Okay.
The 95% confidence that it is uniform. Why not be?
We're going to return to that. Well, yes, again, anything that's random, you can't say 100% for sure it's got to be this. So, so the confidence is that, I'll return to that, exactly what this means, because it's a bit less satisfactory. We'll see, it's a bit less satisfactory than the confidence intervals, which are, and we'll see why, sort of at the end of the lecture. But it's a commonly used test, and people are happy enough to draw conclusions based on it. Okay, so in general, in order to use the test, what you're going to want is to have enough samples to, again, be able to exhibit the proper form of randomness. So, for instance, if you had uniform 0, 1, and you had 2 samples, you're not going to really be able to conclude much. You need to have enough samples in any interval, like a histogram, you really need enough samples to make it sort of start to resemble the curve. Similarly, you're going to want to have enough intervals. So this is, again, quick rules of thumb about the number of intervals, and which is pretty much based on the sample size and sort of, You don't want to sort of have more intervals than you need, because that's more calculations, but you want enough to sort of accurately represent your distribution, and you want to be assured that you're going to get enough samples in each interval. Okay, so we'll return to the chi-square test and look at how it's applied to non-uniform distributions. It's pretty much the same. The only thing is, frequently what you'll do is you'll actually change your interval sizes so that the expected number of samples per interval is equal. So instead of getting the case like I used to describe while you're normalizing, you would actually have an equal number. The following example indicates why the chi-square test is not the be-all and the end-all of testing. Basically, it is a frequency test. And one thing that doesn't look for, then, is patterns in the occurrence of numbers. So you've eliminated the sequencing of numbers from consideration when you do a chi-square test. Essentially, it doesn't matter if you lined them all up, if you ordered the numbers from 1 to 100 or had them randomly distributed. Either way, you'd get the same conclusion from your chi-square test. But obviously, if a person looked at numbers lined up from 1 to 100 in order, they wouldn't conclude that that was very random. You wouldn't expect the numbers to just march up in an increasing order. Okay. And so, additional tests are proposed which examine the order in which numbers occur, our sampled numbers occur, as well as just sort of the numbers themselves. Okay, so again, I talked about ordering things from 1 to 100. If you look at this example, these are the same numbers that we had in our chi-squared example, but you'll notice, again, that for each row, the numbers go up in increasing order from smallest to largest. So you wouldn't really be that happy that that was truly random. Okay. So we'll have a look now at runs tests, which can be used to sort of detect problems like this which have to do with the sequencing of the numbers and not just the actual values of the numbers. Okay. Okay. What are runs? Runs are just sequences of numbers that exhibit a certain property. So, for instance, a run could be numbers that are increasing in value. Okay. And so we frequently refer to runs up and runs down. We can also have runs above and below the mean. And we look at two factors related to runs. We look at the number of runs, and we also look at the length of runs. Okay. So, we have here our n sample numbers, and again, what we're considering now is not just the values, but the ordering in which they were produced. Okay. So, the maximum number of runs that you can have, either up or down, is n minus 1, and the minimum number of runs up or down that you can have is 1. So again, the numbers could march all the way to from smallest to largest, or largest to smallest, or they could bounce every number. Okay. So for these tests, I should also backtrack and say these tests are applied to the uniform distribution. And so for this distribution, we can say something about how many runs we would expect. And so if A is the number of runs, then we can calculate a mean and a variance. Okay. And we can also say that if your sample is large enough, the number of runs tends to be normally distributed. Okay. So, again, looking at our example, we have, this is our sort of second example where everything's increasing. We have 10 runs, all of length 10, and those are all runs up. We have no runs down. And so this gives us a mean, just plugging in, of 66, or sorry, what we would expect is a mean of 66.333 and a variance of 17.46. Our actual value is 10, and this is 13.48 standard deviations away from the expected mean. Okay. And so you'd have to conclude that that's not likely. So, another test you can do is to examine the number of runs above and below the mean. And here we get somewhat more complicated formulas. Don't worry, I wouldn't expect you to reproduce that on the exam. But again, just understand where this is coming from. So if B is the total number of runs, then, again, this is random, so we have an expectation and a variance for B. And again, if we have a long enough sample run, then we'd expect this to be roughly normal. Okay. So again, you can calculate the number that you actually observe, and you can compare that to the mean and calculate how many standard deviations away from the mean you are, and again, hopefully not too far from the mean. Okay. You can also look at the length of runs. And in this case, what you'd do is you'd count up how many runs you had of any given length. We can calculate the expected value. That's on the next slide, and it's not pretty, but you can do it. And then we can compare it to the observed and use our chi-square test to come to a conclusion then about runs lengths and whether the observed runs length seem to adhere to the expected value that we think we should have. Again, the formulae for actually calculating this get a bit long, but you can do it. Okay. So again, the main thing to take out of here is, particularly when you're looking at random number generation, so initially generating that uniform 0-1 distribution that we've based everything else on, that it's worth sort of looking not just at the actual values, but again, looking for these sequencing things as well. And you have some methods for generating the uniform 0-1 will be fine, both in terms of these sequencing tests and in terms of the actual the number distributions. Others won't. Okay. So, for uniform distributions, then we've applied the chi-squared test, and then we've had a look at these other sequencing tests that we can use as well. The last thing we'll do in terms of the chi-squared test is look at non-uniform distributions. And so again here, we're just looking at, the main application here would be if we had our sample data and we'd picked a distribution to just try and assure ourselves that that distribution is indeed the correct one. And so the procedure is more or less similar to what we would have had for the uniform distribution, with the sort of two caveats. So again, we'll just run through an example to see how it works. And in this case, we have a set of data, not quite as large as before, and we want to model it as using an exponential distribution. And again, to do that, we're going to have to calculate the sample mean to estimate the parameter of the exponential potentially exponential distribution. Okay, so we calculate our sample. We can calculate our sample mean to be 11.83, and our parameter lambda hat is 1 over that, or 0.084. Okay. So that's the first deviation from before we need to do our parameter estimation. The next complication is that what we would like to do is choose intervals for which the expected number of samples is equal. Okay. So if you had an exponential distribution and you divided it up normally, you'd have a tail where you'd expect very few samples, and you'd have a range where you'd expect many more samples. Instead, what we're going to do is we're going to vary the size of the intervals so that the number of samples per interval should be the same. Okay. And we can do that by just using the CDF. And so if you choose 8 intervals, then you'd want an equal probability of falling in each interval. And then you can get your input endpoint by solving IP. So that's how much probability you have caught through the up to and including the ith interval, and solve for our endpoint AI. Okay. And so what we'll see here is that our interval sizes are increasing as we go down. And the goal of that is to catch the same, have the same expected number of samples per interval. Okay, so we've chosen our interval sizes. We have the expected, same expected number of occurrences per interval. Then we have to go through and actually count how many intervals we have, or how many occurrences we have per interval. And once we do that, so we have OI, we have EI, we can calculate our chi-squared value, which in this case comes out to 39.6. Okay. So we just want to run our chi-squared test. We had 8 intervals. You take away one, just because once you've done 7 of those intervals, everything else is fixed. But we also had to estimate one parameter, so we remove one more degree of freedom relating to the estimated parameter. Okay. We pick a significance level of 5%. And we see that our significance, our critical value, sorry, is 12.592. And our chi-squared value is greater than that. So what we conclude is that our sample is not exponentially distributed. Okay, so I said I'd return to what these conclusions actually meant. And this will be the sort of wrap-up. And I always found, at least when somebody first floated this idea to me, and I forget, whatever class, I thought it was quite strange. And so it's something that you have to sit down and think about. So I'm warning you ahead that, I'll be saying things and they may or may not make sense to you. Okay. And so the question is, what is the actual interpretation of our test? And to answer that question, we're going to take a step back and define a bit of terminology, and if you've ever taken a statistics course, well, then probably this does look okay to you, and you've heard all this before. If you haven't, again, just sit down and think about it. Okay. So a hypothesis is an assumption or an assertion we make about our system. It's what we want to test. A null hypothesis is just another way of saying a hypothesis, but it's one where we assume that nothing out of the ordinary is happening. So, for instance, the underlying distribution of the samples is uniform 0,1. So this is the hypothesis we've made for our chi-square test. The only reason that the null might be significant is that we denote typically our null hypothesis by H0. Okay, and again, this is talked about in Peros. Okay. Yeah, there's a negation then of the null hypothesis, so the distribution of samples is not uniform 0,1. Okay. So the hypothesis is what we want to reason about, and we want to have a hypothesis test is a procedure that allows us to accept or reject our hypotheses. And again, since these things are random and we don't know everything about the system, we may be right or we may be wrong about our conclusions. Okay. And so the actual state of play, which is our hypothesis, can be true or it can be false. That's just fact, but we don't know. And then we have our procedure, and we try and decide whether our hypothesis is true, in which case we don't reject it or we accept it, or it's false, in which case we do reject it. And so you can see there are four ways that reality can match up with our decision. The hypothesis could be true, and that was the conclusion we reached. The hypothesis could be true, but the conclusion we reached was it was false. The hypothesis could be false, that's the conclusion we reached, so it was false. Or the hypothesis can be false and... the hypothesis could be false, but... we concluded that it was true, or the hypothesis could be false, and we concluded that it was false. So, in two cases, we're happy, these valid cases, because our conclusion matched reality, and in two cases, we're not happy because our conclusion didn't match reality. And so we distinguish between the two cases where we were wrong. Type 1 errors, the hypothesis is correct, but we reject it. Type 2 errors, the hypothesis was wrong, but we accepted it. Okay. And so... typically... when we have a test and something like the chi-square test, the significance level is representing the probability that we make a type 1 error so that the hypothesis is true and we reject it. So... I'll leave that for a minute. Okay. So, in order to have full assurance about our system, or reason fully about our system, what we really want is we want a pair of hypotheses. Our everything is normal and the negation of that our underlying distribution was not as we expected. Okay. Now, since these are sort of negations of each other, if you could test these both for type 1 errors, then you would get both type 1 and type 2. You'd get the conclusion for type 1 and type 2 for H0. So you'd know... the probability of it being true and us rejecting it, but you'd also know the probability of it being false and we accepted it. Unfortunately, you can't really test the underlying distribution is not something. It's impossible to prove that. So you can't test for both types of errors. Okay, so again, the example that we have to work with for that is our chi-squared test, and our hypothesis is that the sample values have a certain distribution, which is the one that we've chosen. The negation of that hypothesis is that they don't have a certain distribution. And so we apply the chi-square test to H0. We do have a certain distribution. Okay. And so for a given significance level, we compare it to the critical value. And so what we're given is, again, the probability of a type 1 error. So if our chi-square value is greater than the critical value, we can say it's really improbable that it has this distribution. So to some extent, the conclusion we should draw from this test is if our chi-squared value is greater than our critical value, we've proved that it's not this distribution. In actuality, the conclusion that, again, we've said we've drawn, and in general people are happy enough to go along thinking with, is that if our chi-square value is less than the critical value, then we accept that our hypothesis, so we accept that we are distributed as we chose. So it's technically not quite right. Okay. Think about it. You're actually drawing the wrong conclusion from the chi-squared test. The only sort of defense of this is it tends to work out pretty well most of the time anyway, because there tends to be a relationship between these two probabilities, the probability of a type 1 and a type 2 error. So generally, you're actually drawing the wrong conclusion, but it's an accepted way of doing it, so beyond thinking about it for now, most people just go ahead and do it. Okay, so again, what have we done in this lecture? We've looked at comparing samples to uniform and other distributions. We've looked at why we do this. And then we've said the chi-square test is is one commonly used test for doing this. And so the last sort of little bit of the lecture was just saying why this is not quite right, but again, it works out in practice well enough. Okay, so that's it for me for today. We'll take a short, maybe 10-minute break, and then the demonstrator will be back to talk to you about your assignment. Okay?